Great Britain and Japan, two nations once defined by order and cultural continuity, are now unraveling under the same globalist forces of mass demographic change.
Police emergency.
Yeah, we've just been attacked by someone racially.
In Britain, years of anti-racism indoctrination have crippled policing, producing a two-tier justice system.
Your officers assisted in that man's death.
That protects minority feelings over public safety.
In fact, Henry told officers that he could not breathe 9 times. He told them he had been stabbed 4 times. The response from one officer was, "I don't think you have, mate."
He was actually treated in a way that meant an accusation of a racial slur was treated more seriously than an act of murder. What does he say? "I can't breathe." Familiar words? Remember career criminal George Floyd, who died in appalling circumstances in Midwest America a few years ago. Remember the reaction to that and the way the police behaved. Within a few days, Keir Starmer was taking the knee. Black Lives Matter exploded all over the country. Churchill's statue was defaced. The cenotaph was vandalized. And yet, what has the public reaction been from our leaders and politicians? And indeed, to be frank, much of the media to this. Silence. Absolute silence. Proof, if ever there was any, that we're living in a two-tier culture in this country where the rights and privileges of white people matter less than those of ethnic minorities.
When we have police cars with pride flags on it, which is a politicised movement, we know that the police, who are supposed to be impartial, are often anything but. They are driven by an ideology, a Marxist, cultural Marxist ideology, that is not right, that is not good, and it's against you, and we're seeing two-tier policing, we're seeing two-tier justice, two-tier politics, and the people of Britain have had enough of it.
The outrage has exploded as Nigel Farage, Parliament, and even John Cleese expose how religious exemptions shield violence while native citizens face the consequences.
But no matter the pain we feel, there is no justification for more violence and disorder. The attacks directed towards police officers in Southampton last night were disgraceful and completely unacceptable. This is a time for serious work, not rage. And let me be clear, we will ensure anyone found engaging in disorder meets the full force of the law, as we have done before.
Under the Criminal Justice Act 1988 and Offensive Weapons Act 2019, carrying a bladed weapon in public carries up to 4 years in prison for ordinary Brits, yet Sikhs receive a statutory religious defense for the kirpan, allowing public carry even as prosecutors admitted Digwa chose a larger 21-centimeter blade beyond his compliant neck kirpan. France, Denmark, Sweden, Italy, and the UAE have banned public kirpan carry outright with Sikh compliance. But UK authorities cling to the exemption, effectively arming one group while disarming the native people with no way to defend themselves. Further east, Japan, long a holdout against this chaos through post-war restrictions and the 1952 Immigration Control Act, now faces its own opening salvo. 10 ancient temples and shrines, including one from 807 AD and a World Heritage Site, have been torched in the first 5 months of 2026 alone, despite automation over cheap labor and strong public opposition to large-scale immigration. Japan's quiet visa expansions and cultural arson signal the same globalist pressure hell-bent on eroding identity. Britain surrendered to the script and got two-tier chaos. Japan resisted and still watches its soul set ablaze. Proof that dilution of a people's history, safety, and cohesion is not progress. It's engineered collapse. John Bowne reporting.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, coming to you live this Thursday, the 4th of June, 2026. Very glad to be here with you. We've got a lot of news to get into, some major developments, and a call to action, because I think we're very, very close to the deadline. I think what we're seeing happen all over the world are all various aspects of one singular plot. I think you may know this. If you're a regular viewer of the Alex Jones Network, you may be aware we've got this little idea about a global corporate combine trying to take over the planet and enslave us all. And I think we're seeing the various aspects of this all put into place. And it's kind of terrifying because so many people are so blind to this. And it's the type of thing that's so big, so overwhelming, so comprehensive that, like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like either this is actually what it's all about. This is actually why all these things are happening. We really are watching as the walls of the prison are being built around us. Or I'm insane, or I'm an insane person. But it's the type of thing where it's like, all right, all this stuff is happening. It certainly seems like it's all pushing in the same direction. It certainly seems like it's all being set up for a certain purpose. And yet nobody seems to recognize it. Nobody else seems to see it. And I don't know. I feel a little bit like Chicken Little. I feel a little bit like the sky is falling. Only it really is falling. And it's not going to be good. In other words, there's all this stuff going on, just some of it quietly, some of it more aggressively. But it's all building to a singular major conflict, I feel. And this is what's going on with Russia and Ukraine. This is what's going on in the Middle East. But it's also what's going on here domestically, where once again, I see the way that the right wing is using the energy of the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, the Trump phenomenon, to guide us towards our own destruction and to basically use our concerns to justify building their control grid. I'm going to show you a video from a woman that lays this all out in a very powerful way. But mostly, I think the deadline, the reason I feel a certain pressure, impetus to cover all this stuff right now is, of course, Section 224 of the 2027 National Defense Authorization Act. Former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene says the United States of America is a sovereign nation. Section 224 of the 2027 National Defense Authorization Act must be removed. Our military should not be integrated in any capacity with a foreign country's military, nor should we be funding it. She, of course, is talking about this aspect of the NDAA, which is sort of one of these must-pass bills, right? Because it's the funding for the military. It's going to pass, and so they're trying to get it passed with this addendum. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wrote a letter to the House of Representatives where he takes credit, calling it his plan, calling it, quote, my plan. I was glad to receive your proposed congressional resolution endorsing my plan to shift the framework for U.S.-Israel defense cooperation from aid to partnership. As I said in our meeting in Jerusalem on May 27, 2026, Israel deeply appreciates the financial component of the military aid the United States has generously provided over the years. The time has now arrived for us to move from aid recipient to partner. I'm heartened by your enthusiastic support for our plan to develop a new memorandum of understanding with the United States government that will draw down U.S. financial military assistance over the next decade and replace it with what you refer to as, quote, a new framework of joint defense cooperation, co-development, co-production, and mutual investments in areas including advanced missile defense, artificial intelligence, unmanned systems, cybersecurity, and the next generation military platforms. I also appreciate your commitment to fighting the scourge of anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world. You know, this letter alone, I think, makes its own argument as to why we shouldn't do this. In this letter, he acknowledges the, quote, generously provided financial aid from the United States over the years. But there's no attempt to repay it. there's no attempt, there's no display of gratitude beyond the, you know, performative, perfunctory statement of gratitude, but there's no give, there's no return, there's no mutual benefit. It's, hey, thanks for all that stuff you've given us all over the years. I think we're ready to be, you know, fully partnered in now. And it's just like, you know, yeah, thanks for all that stuff that you did for us. Yeah, that was great or whatever. But we, like, actually want to be in charge now. There's a certain level of ingratitude expressed by the Israelis that represents the reality of the situation in that they don't care about us. They don't like us. They aren't working for our benefit. They're exploiting us for their benefit. They are now trying and succeeding in, by the way, and by the way, this would only codify and make official what is already happening through the corporate invasion of our military and domestic surveillance. Palantir is an Israeli company. It might not be headquartered. Maybe it is headquartered in Israel. I'm not even sure. I'm pretty sure it's headquartered in San Francisco. But its leadership are diehard Jewish supremacist Israelis. That's who they work for. That's who they care about. That's who they're deploying their services to serve. They don't care about America. They don't give a damn about American problems. And they're only going to make them worse. They think about Americans in the same way they think about Gazans. When are we going to understand this fully? And how unbelievably stupid would we be to hand over control of our military to them? Because in effect, that is what would happen with this partnership, quote unquote partnership, this agreement. These are people who, and maybe we just need to play the Eighth Front War today. Maybe we need to play it again. So you can hear them in their own words express how they view the current conflict in the world, where they say we have to win the next war against Rome and America is the new Rome, and that we need the genius that brought Apollo pagers to Hezbollah to be enacted in this war against America. You know, the Eighth Front War documentary, I originally, you know, its title is The Eighth Front, Israel's War on Reality. It was originally going to be Israel's War on America, because that's actually what is being expressed there. Of course, the war they're waging in America is an information war, so it is a war on reality. It's a war on truth. But really, at the end of the day, it's a war on America. The lies, the deception, the manipulation, it's in service of exploiting America to the maximum degree. I don't know why it's so hard for people to understand that this really is what's motivating them, that America being weaker because of our partnership with them is not a negative to them. It's on purpose. It's a part of it. Like, the question is, why would Benjamin Netanyahu write this letter? Why would he take credit for this? Do you think he doesn't know that the American people do not want their military integrated with Israel's? You think he doesn't know that the vast majority of Americans now see Israel as a genocidal apartheid state that should be wiped off the earth? Why would he take credit for this? Why would he write a letter claiming that this was his idea the whole time? Does he think it's a good idea? And people are going to be like, wow, Benjamin Netanyahu, another great idea from him. Like, he knows what he's doing. They know what they're doing. This, I see as the fulfillment of the occult requirement to inform your victims of what you're doing before you do it, to morally offload the karmic backlash you would otherwise get. That they're stating in no uncertain words that they're taking over the United States military, and if we let them, we deserve it. This is Benjamin Netanyahu's idea. And they're not thankful for what we've given them before. It's only whetted their appetite. The iPhones are now being built in Israel, the chipset, meaning that Israel will have root access at the physical hardware level to basically the most popular phone used in America, used by everybody. They obviously are the heart and soul of Palantir, which has already been incorporated into our entire federal system, where they are monitoring our entire federal government, every single person. They're also being integrated in with ICE, which is using the outrage that right-wingers feel about illegal immigrants to accrue to themselves all sorts of extraordinary powers, build all sorts of extraordinary infrastructure, and yet they're not doing mass deportations. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Oh, if you want us to do mass deportations, you got to, you know, incorporate Palantir into our surveillance system. You got to, you know, build concentration camps all around the country. You know, if you really want us to do these deportations, you've got to allow us to, you know, be trained by the IDF and wear ski masks and not provide a warrant to search. You know, if you want us to do mass deportations, this is what it's going to take. We say, okay, you've got the green light. You've got everything that you need. And then they don't do mass deportations. What does that tell you? That that's not what it's for? So it must be for something else. What else could it be for? What else do you think it could possibly be used for, having this massive, unaccountable domestic police force with quick reaction forces staged in every single state, with room in every single state, prisons, concentration camps to house 10 to 20,000 people per camp, and at least two of them per state? They're not using them to deport people. They're not filling these locations up with illegal migrants, but they're building them. And we're at the most 2 years and a couple months away from a potential radical Democrat office holder. And all of this is being built up, is being in, whether it's, you know, it's the ICE facilities being built, it's the precedent being set of denaturalizing people or expelling people from this country because of their anti-Semitism. It's the anti-Semitism laws being passed at the state level, slowly but surely chipping away at the First Amendment. What do you think all of this is for? Why are they behaving in such an egregious way? They get us into the war in Iran. They bomb Lebanon every time we're close to a peace deal. Horrifically, again, just abject, blatant genocide against an innocent population. They're like torturing prisoners to death, raping them, you know, at an industrial scale, and it's becoming known and nobody does anything about it. They don't pay any price. They don't suffer any consequence. So I have to wonder if it's not being released on purpose. Because again, this is the danger of exposure without punishment. This is like why it's a problem with that Jeffrey Epstein files were released and nobody was arrested over it. Hell, even the UK, people lost their jobs. And there were investigations, you know, France at least like raided the Rothschild office as a consequence of the Epstein files. Nothing happened to the people here in America. So previously, where we could have, you know, speculated about the crimes people committed, even though they're walking around free, now they come out and tell us, oh, you're right, we have committed these crimes, we are involved in this treasonous activity, and guess what? Still nothing is happening. What do you think that does? It normalizes the idea that they can get away with anything. It induces in the population a learned helplessness that says it doesn't even matter if we expose them for their crimes because they don't pay for them anyway, so why should we even bother exposing them? Why, when we essentially lost the Iran war a week into it, are we persisting in trying to keep this conflict going now 3 months in, 100 days into this war, when it was lost in the first two or three? And we knew it was lost. Again, this is the value of having a place like the Alex Jones Network on air, because we can sit here and go, we've looked at the numbers, we looked at the strategy. This does not get any better from here on out. And I said on probably the fifth day of the war, I said, this is the point where we could turn around, say, never mind, forget this, and actually not suffer that many consequences. Well, why are we persisting in it? Why, if Ukraine lost the Ukraine war in 2023, essentially, are they persisting to a really radical degree where now there's videos of Ukraine soldiers who'd already been to the front line, lost limbs, in the front line, you now have amputees being dragged off the street, remobilized, sent back to the front lines to fight more because they are systematically eliminating the population of Ukraine. Russia is bombing Kiev for the first time in the entire war. They are clearly and keep sending very unsubtle signals. I mean, they aren't even signals. They're just coming out and saying, they're like, we will use nuclear weapons. We have nuclear, a nuclear arsenal. We do not have to put up with this. We don't have to put up with Ukraine bombing civilian apartment buildings in Moscow or blowing up buses in Russia. We can put an end to this by using nuclear weapons, and we can take on all of Europe and not even really sweat it, but we don't want to. Why are you pushing us? And yet they keep pushing. The Ukraine war, which was lost 3 years ago, it's been 3 years of relentless but pointless murder, endlessly, with no end in sight, and really with every action, every single day, ramping up, elevating, and making more dangerous the entire situation in Europe. So again, if you know all of this, if you are looking around and you're especially seeing the intensity with which the anti-Semitism push is being made, you know, if you look at Australia, again, it's the best example where you had the first, you have years of the Jewish community pressuring Australia relentlessly, just constantly. You've got to limit free speech. You've got to shut down, you know, people who are anti-Israel, presenting action plans, right? We've shown the video, the J7 woman who's like, yeah, we represent the biggest Jewish diasporas, and we've been pressuring the Australian government for years, you know, to do this, presenting them with plans and, you know, really pressuring them. And if there's one thing Jewish organizations are good at, it's putting pressure on people. But nothing happens until Bondi Beach, till the Bondi Beach massacre. Now, whether that was a legitimate massacre or not, I'll leave you to look into. Regardless, lo and behold, all of the sudden, the one thing they needed to get all of these laws passed happens. And so all of these laws pass. And so now you have, you know, people being thrown into prison in Australia literally for just opposing Israel. And that's actually on the books. That's what people are being thrown into prison for. And you can extrapolate that. You can expand that out, right? That's the beauty of anti-Semitism, is even if you are just saying back to them what they say to you, that can be anti-Semitism, right? Just yesterday, there was some Jewish organization that was like, Pride is Jewish. Jewish people started Pride. Jewish people were the forces behind normalizing homosexuality. They say that. It's wonderful. It's good. It's beautiful. It's the light of the world. It's tikkun olam. But I say, hey, you know all this gay crap? You know why your kid is being taught by his teacher to chop his willy off? You know that all started with the Jews, right? Well, that's anti-Semitism. It doesn't matter. I can just point out to something that a Jewish person is doing literally in the definition. It says, you know, talking about any of this stuff, any crimes committed by Jewish people or groups, real or imagined, it doesn't matter. It's just you can't talk about them. You can't criticize them. You can't be negative about them. You can't even repeat their own words back to them in a different voice, right? At the same time, they're passing even more strict weapon restrictions laws, destroying gun ownership for the average Australian. But they do have a carve out. They do have a little asterisk. There are certain groups, private militia groups in Australia that are allowed to be armed. They're the Jewish groups. Henry Novak is brutally murdered, and Keir Starmer gives video, you know, makes video after video, speech after speech, basically saying, shut up. There's nothing we can do about this. Any attempt to change anything to deal with the consequences or the cause of this murder, you're evil, you're bad. Two Jewish guys get stabbed. It's millions of dollars to the Jewish community. I swear on my mother's grave, I will do everything in my power to guarantee that you are safe and that you know you're belonged. And it's just an outpouring. And they, of course, have their, you know, Shamrim or whatever they call it, private police force. They're allowed to carry weapons. They're allowed to do things that other people aren't allowed to do. So the question is, if you see all of this happening, am I the crazy one for feeling like I'm watching the Death Star be built? That's how it feels. It feels like once this stuff is all in place, once it's all operational, how are you going to resist it? How are you going to speak out against it? How are you going to gather enough people together to have a protest against this, especially when everybody learns? You know, you only need to do it to a few people. A few people need to suffer the consequences, the doctrine of severity, and everybody else will learn to keep their damn mouth shut. I see a digital panopticon being built from the data centers to the ICE facilities to the integration of Palantir to the digital IDs to the control of AI and the censorship of social media. These are all the components of a Death Star. You don't build a Death Star for no reason. You build a Death Star to blow up planets. You don't put all of these things in place to make little animated memes, right? You don't build these data centers out with this ruthless aggression, destroying entire communities, robbing people's homes, spending all the money you get from the government, so now you're having to dip into savings accounts and retirement accounts that you manage because you're so desperate to get this done right now, and it's worth it at any cost. The only thing that makes sense to me is that they really feel like they're about to shut that prison door. They're about to turn that lock, and they're about to completely destroy any exit that we have from the system that they're building. And I feel like if this bill passes, because this is the way it works, right? With other stuff that the Israelis don't want, you know, a law passes, but does it really pass? Does it really matter? Is it really enforced? Who's going to enforce it? Nobody. All right, well, then DEI still exists on college campuses. You can pass a law about DEI. It doesn't really matter. But when it's Israel and when it's something like the military, if this passes, that's it. It goes into the assembly line and it moves forward and they combine, the Israeli and the American military. And once that happens, it will be impossible to extricate them ever again. And we're going to be permanently tied to this genocidal little psychotic state that is destroying us. Let me lay out some background so you can understand the warning I'm trying to get across here. I'm going to go to clip number 22 now. I think one of the biggest aspects of the global control grid that's moving forward relentlessly and regardless of how people feel about it, it's things like digital ID. They're doing it through government where they can, in places like the UK. But short of that, they'll just get the companies to do it for them. They'll get the websites or the service providers themselves to check your age, which is, of course, scanning your face and logging it in a facial recognition database. The point is to tie you biometrically to your digital clone so they can track absolutely everything that you ever do, anything that you ever purchase, just absolutely everything about you in an effort to control you. But that's where humans are involved. They're doing this to literally everything. This is why they're building the data centers. They are tokenizing the world, and they're using AI and mass surveillance to create a digital copy of the world that they can manipulate at their whim. Let's go to clip 22 here.
Right now, we have Congress negotiating the Clarity Act, and the Clarity Act describes digital tokens. And what we know is that Wall Street and the banking system want to use digital tokens to trade all the other assets, both real assets like your house or your stocks and bonds, your financial assets. And what they've said is they want to move all the stocks and bonds in the world onto a distributive ledger, which gives them then the ability to make it programmable.
I see.
Okay.
Okay.
And the Bank of International Settlements, which has been running the process on central bank digital currency, has announced it's making an inventory of all the assets in the world. So the desk over here is in the BIS inventory, so all assets in the world. And they want to be able to trade all assets with a digital token. I heard one of the creepiest things I've ever heard was a software developer bragging about how cool this was, because you could go to the grocery store and pay for your groceries with 0.01% of your house equity.
Wow.
I know. I said, wow. Right. So here's what's very confusing. If you look at the debate about the Clarity Act, it's still not clear to me exactly how they're proposing the system is going to work. And if you read all the different sort of things that can be found on what they're proposing, I think it's still very fluid. Okay. So you just need to remember now, DTC is basically the archive of who owns what stock and bonds. And it runs that process for $114 trillion of stocks and bonds. DTC has just announced, even though the Clarity Act hasn't finalized yet, that they are planning on moving everything. They're launching their distributed ledger system to trade everything with tokens, along with 50 major financial institutions. So really? This is moving very, very quickly. And Washington right now is in deep debate about the details of how this is going to work. And I'm delighted to talk about all of that. But what is important for people listening to know is the financial system is moving quickly to institute an all-digital financial system, which is no longer going to be financial system as we know it. It's a control system. It's a technocratic control system. And what we need to know is, okay, well, what do I do? And what you do is you do everything to slow them down or stop them. Because this is a vision that if the bankers control fiscal policy, that is the end of taxation with representation. That is taxation without representation. That is the end of the Constitution.
That's as a practical point. Matter.
And we're already dangerously close to that. Psychopaths are on the system. That's the warning from investment banker Catherine Austin Fitz, the former Wall Street insider, says most people can't imagine a world where powerful institutions would seek greater surveillance, control, and influence over everyday life. Why? Because healthy people assume everyone shares the same values. Spoiler, they don't. Again, if you study all of this stuff, you recognize how all of these things seem to be playing into the same process, right? What is the consequence of inflation ticking up year over year? Well, for wealthy people whose wealth is almost entirely in property, that means their wealth is going up, right? They don't worry about the cash in their bank account. That represents like less than 1% of their actual wealth. You look at somebody like Elon Musk, he's worth $1 trillion. I don't even know how many dollars he has actually in dollars. It's all stocks and ownership of various companies and, using certain property as collateral to get bank loans. I mean, it's all sort of woo-woo stuff. But, when the value of the money goes down, it means the value of the property goes up correspondingly. So rich people whose wealth is entirely tied up in properties and companies and valuations, their wealth goes up. The average person ends up just spending more of their money, dwindling the supply. So as they continue to print money to fund the wars that Israel wanted, to drive Americans into bankruptcy, lowering and devaluing the amount our dollars are worth, while correspondingly rising the stock portfolios of the billionaires, it's a squeeze. It's not like an outright robbery. But that's what all of these things are. It's like, let's just turn this up a little bit, turn inflation up just a little bit, just make it so that people can't save quite as much money as they were before. They got to dip into their savings, pay $7 instead of $5 for a meal every day over time. That amounts to a hell of a lot of money. And it just means that your savings or your potential savings that you could have had otherwise is just diminished. It's just lowered just a little bit. And then they'll implement like death taxes. So the older generations that were actually able to save and maybe even inherited and grew generational wealth, that'll be stripped from them, be stripped from you. The inheritance will go away. And maybe to get around that, people start spending their money more before they die. And essentially what you're left with is you follow all these different trends, all these different pressures, all these different incentives, is that we're headed inextricably, unwaveringly towards a world in which people just don't have money. You are literally operating on sort of a paradigm of the company store where you're working for credits that you have to spend regardless of what you want to do. It'll be the rent, it'll be the food, it'll be, and basically whether they are forcing you to stop purchasing things or just make it more expensive, same type of thing. It's like you've got these ticks that are stopping people from eating meat. At the same time, you've got regulations and, you know, USDA requirements forcing the closure of all of the small meat processors. It's like they're just, it's just this constriction, this slow but sure constriction of the food supply, especially the meat supply. They want you on soy and corn, basically. They want you weak. They want you helpless. They want you spending what little money you do have just trying to, you know, have a nice meal. It's like when it was Kevin Leary or whoever, one of these scumbag oligarchs is talking about, you know, Americans being poor because they're not willing to, like, eat a peanut butter on white bread sandwich every day for lunch. Yeah, Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary. And it's like, do you understand that in the year 2026 in America, the greatest country, most prosperous, richest country by far the world has ever known, you're telling its citizens to basically starve? you have to eat white bread. Well, we continue to be the most prosperous country in the history of the world, that we can lose hundreds of billions of dollars to Somalis and we somehow don't even notice for a couple years. Like, but none of our citizens benefit from that. When you see all of this stuff, all these various components all falling into place, again, it's about the control system, but it's also about the crushing of your will, the elimination of generational wealth, the elimination of intelligence and, you know, higher thought that's necessary to actually provide the intellectual underpinning for a genuine revolution. They are building a permanent control grid that will use financial surveillance and any other system of control that they can get their hands on to very subtly but surely crush us to death, right? I've said this the entire time I've worked at InfoWars, and I explain this because I noticed it in 2016 with Donald Trump. The way I'd always explain it is that plan A for the globalist was like Hillary Clinton. If Hillary Clinton had got elected, they would have used the fake news psyop to start rounding up independent media. They would have claimed that Trump was a Russian agent. It would have been bad, and that would have just sort of like in a chute, like in a, you know, on a mechanized walkway. We're just on the path towards globalism and we don't even know it. We're just, you know, blind idiots following the Pied Piper towards our doom. And that was the original plan. And that's the ideal plan. The ideal for the globalist is to destroy you without you noticing, right? That's what they really want. Or even to get you to participate in your own destruction, if you happen to notice it. By voting for Trump, that was a rejection of that worldview. During the first administration, especially during the first election, especially, the things he was saying, the positions he was holding, they were an outright, abject, blatant rejection of globalism. I mean, he would say it, nationalism, not globalism, will be our credo. And the metaphor I'd always use is it's like they're trying to capture a tiger because they're scared of humanity. The powers that be, the globalists, the world leaders live in constant fear of being exposed and basically being torn apart by the mob because they know they deserve it. And so we're the tiger to them, right? We're a very dangerous animal to them. They want us in a cage. If the tiger's in a cage, they're a lot easier to poke with a stick, right? They can't do anything about it. And so they're building this cage. They have a cage in the woods, in the forest, and they're trying to trick the tiger into going into it. And so they put, you know, little pieces of fish in a trail leading into the cage. And essentially for a couple decades, the tiger of America was sort of following the trail and heading right in the direction of the cage. And they were sitting, you know, they were hiding in the bushes, waiting for us to get into the cage so they could slam that door shut. And then 2016, the Trump election was sort of the tiger looking up for the first time and seeing the cage and going, well, wait a second. What the hell is this? I don't think I want to go in here. And the tiger kind of starts to back up a little bit. Now, if you're hunting a tiger, you got two choices at this point. You can go, ooh, he almost got wise to us. We better back off a little bit. Better make him feel safe for a little while. Cage? What cage? What are you talking about? If there was a cage, why would they let you elect Donald Trump? You crazy conspiracy theorists think everything's controlled. Donald Trump got elected, right? And he's making big moves. And you know, maybe you're wrong about all of this. Maybe you need to put your guard down a little bit. Maybe you need to relax, right? That would have been one move they could have made. They could have backed off. They could have realized, ooh, we've been found out. We better chill for a little bit to lower the defenses. They went with the other option. The other option was to reach out and grab the tiger and try to shove it forcefully into the cage. So obviously in that situation, there's no hiding it anymore. It just becomes obvious. Yep, you saw the cage. Well, too bad. We're still going to try to shove you in it. So now it's a fight. And now we're, you know, pushing back and they're pushing forward. And it's sort of, up to us to just actively and vehemently resist all of this. Resist being put in the cage because we know what happens once that cage door is shut. And so, since like 2016, there's been this vicious battle between the tiger of humanity and the, vicious hunters of the globalists trying to force us into it. But they would prefer if we had just walked right in. They'd prefer if we'd just willingly go with them. Which the easiest way to get somebody to go along with it is to either keep them from the knowledge, which is possible to a certain extent, but then once, you're implementing digital ID, once you're actually doing it to them in a way that affects their life, you got to come out with it. You got to reveal what it is that you're doing. And so you want to either portray it as a good thing and get them to go along with it, or basically make it to where it appears as though it's happening spontaneously and nobody's actually deciding. And I know it's kind of crazy to say this, but like, that really is the vibe that most people operate on. That like, I don't know why, I just always say that to be a conspiracy theorist, you just got to understand things don't just happen. Like, people are going to think that this is just happening. Like, they're just going to get a letter from their bank one day that's like, hey, by the way, we're not doing cash anymore. So everything's digital. And, to help make this transition smoother, we're going to give you $1,000. And people are just going to go, whoa, my bank just gave me $1,000. They're like not even going to notice the digital part. They're not going to care. I don't like using cash anyway. It's fine. Who cares? And they're going to treat it like the sunrise. They're going to treat it like the dew on the morning grass. They're going to treat it as a spontaneous event that just sort of occurred and that nobody had the ability to foresee or to forestall or to say anything about. It just sort of happens. It's just, there are experts out there somewhere in the Ethereum and they're making these decisions on technocratic lines. And this is just the way it is. The world is progressing. Things are happening. Developments are occurring. And it's just, we just got to deal with it. It's like people, because they know, like intellectually, if you ask people like, how did, if your bank shifts from cash to being a cash-free digital endeavor, did that just sort of happen? Did a computer decide? Did God decide it? No, human beings had meetings. They said, here's what we want to do. Here's why we want to do it. It's going to be expensive to do. It's going to be hard to do. So it's got to be worth it. So what is it worth it? Why is it worth it to them to do this? Why are they making this decision? Why are they choosing this path for you? And why don't they want you to know about it? Things don't just happen. Digital ID isn't just manifesting spontaneously like a thunderstorm. It is a plot. It is a plan. There are human beings in boardrooms making decisions, implementing programs, instructing employees to design how to sell it to you. These things are on purpose. There are human beings deciding it. And the only thing that will stop them is stopping them. The only thing that will get people aware enough to stop them is to tell people about what's going on and hope to God they've got enough discernment and I don't know, human soul left in them that they can understand why you don't want a giant cabal of psychotic billionaires to be in control of the entire world down to every blade of grass and the tree in your front yard. And by the way, you also are going to be tokenized. You are going to be assigned a value. You are going to be treated like a sack of meat in all of this, when all of this is done. So again, it's just, when you look at everything all at once in a comprehensive and universal way, it is a inescapable conclusion that all of this is on purpose. It's all tied in together, and it's all pointing towards one ultimate outcome, which is a digital panopticon control grid for people who are trying to systematically reorganize all of human society away from tradition, away from family, away from the human individual, towards a mechanized, inhuman, dystopian ant pile world of surveillance, control, coercion, and by the way, at the heart of it, ruthless and brutal violence. Because that's what undergirds all of this. That's what ensures all of this is able to continue, is any opposition to it will be met by ruthless, monopolistic force from the people in charge. So, you know, we're still the tiger. We are still free. The cage is still not closed around us. But we can see them building the bars, and we do have to bite them. We do have to bite them in the neck, metaphorically, symbolically. But we do still have claws, you know. We do still have teeth. They are still human beings. All of this, of course, metaphysical, politically, obviously. Let's go now to clip number 12, because this woman, I think, absolutely gets it and is approaching the situation with the appropriate approbation, anger, fury, righteous indignation, and damn near panic level extremity, because this is happening very, very soon. And I genuinely think this Section 224 could very well be the death knell of our civilization, since not because it will be the stake driven into our heart, but if it passes, it's the equivalent of creating the stake, lining it up with your heart, and waiting for the hammer blow to fall. Let's watch.
I'm really sick of sticking my neck on the line to sound the alarm for you guys, just for you to hop in the comments and be like, you're fear-mongering, but I'm going to try this one more time, and I'm never doing this again, so you better listen to me and listen to me good. We need to rip Donald Trump, his entire administration, all of AIPAC and Israel out of the United States of America, root and stem right now. We don't have another moment to waste. We don't get to go back and forth. There is no more debating. The lines have been drawn. It needs to happen right now, immediately. Everything that has happened in the past year has been leading up to this very moment, and they are in the final stages of executing their overall plan. In the coming days, Congress is going to be voting on legislation that would merge the United States military with the Israeli military. And why the would they do that? Buckle your tits up, because I'm going to tell you. It's because United States servicemen are not going to commit a genocide against American women and children on American soil, but the IDF will. You guys keep thinking the war crimes in Lebanon or the genocide in Palestine are isolated events funded by your tax dollars, that's why your life is so expensive. That is a preview of what they intend on doing to you. They have already consolidated all of the power to the executive branch. Out of the 1,200 directives listed in Project 25, over 1,000 have been implemented. Everything that they've said they're going to do thus far, they have fucking done. ICE is more funded than the Marine Corps, and they are actively deployed to a fucking useless war that we got into with Iran on behalf of Israel, that Donald Trump said, yeah, we went to war with Iran because of Israel. Israel is calling the shots here. And you think that they want to merge the militaries for what? To take over the Middle East? They're expanding ICE detention centers at an alarming rate. They are trying to put two in every single state with a maximum holding capacity of 10,000 people, but never to exceed a stay of 60 days. Do you guys understand that they are putting incinerators in there? The Department of Justice is trying to bring back death by firing squad, and now they have new manifestos outside of Project 25, Project Esther, Project 26, which detail how they intend on eradicating the United States of America of 100 million citizens. That is one-third of the population. That means that if you do not act now and you stay here, you have a 33.333% chance of it being you and your kids in an incinerator at an ICE detention center or dying by a firing squad. Donald Trump is the one who handed us the fuck over on a silver platter. I voted for him because he's a good businessman, and he treated the United States like a business, one that was going out of business, that needed to be liquidated, and he chopped that shit off, and he sold it off for all his fucking profit, and now every last member of his fucking family is plotting their fucking escape. They're moving to fucking Argentina. They're buying islands in fucking Albania. They're building billion-dollar bunkers in fucking Hawaii. All of the fucking signs are there. They're jumping ship because they got out of the United States what they fucking wanted, and now they do not care what happens to you. Larry Fink, king of fucking Zionists and owner of BlackRock, went on national fucking television. Do you know what BlackRock owns? Your fucking mortgages, your savings account, every bank you bank with, your Roth IRA, your 401k. And when they said, well, we ran out of tax dollars to spend on developing the infrastructure to maintain the AI surveillance centers, so we're going to use your savings accounts and your retirement funds to build that shit, so we have the technology and ease we need to hunt you down and put you in detention centers. Your tax dollars built the detention centers, and your retirement is building the AI surveillance software they need to hunt you the fuck down. Say I'm being dramatic, but the IDF is already here on American soil collecting a paycheck working for ICE. We have confirmation.
All right, folks, we got to go to a commercial break, but I'm going to actually pick this up on the other side. We'll let it finish in the next hour. Stay with us, folks. It's War Room, War Room Live, AlexJonesLive.com. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Again, I wish I could credit this woman, but I'm not sure who she is. The crew is trying to look it up. The only thing we've been able to find is a suspended X account. But I think she's exactly right. So we're going to go back to this video. And again, I'll supplement it with, you know, other videos from today that really give credence and, you know, shows you how important what she's saying is. So again, she's talking about AIPAC, Israel, the IDF. I mean, there's something like 20,000 to 30,000 IDF soldiers here in America, many of whom have committed war crimes. Like, there have been interviews. We played them here because there was a media outlet that, pretended to be the IDF. They, like, pretended to call, like, they called a soldier and said, oh, yeah, we're with the IDF. You know, we're your superior commanding officer. We want to interview you about your experience. And they get them to admit all these crazy things. And one of the guys was he's a dude that you'd pass on the street in Chicago. He lives in Chicago. He's an American. He grew up here. And he went to Gaza and murdered an entire family, shot a little kid. When the dad rushed out to help him, he shot the dad. When the brother rushed out to check on the dad, he shot the brother. And his comment was, I don't know what the big deal was. Why'd they want to go, you know, look at a dead body? They're stupid for doing it. I don't feel bad for killing him. And that guy's living in Chicago right now. He could be your next door neighbor there. Are they going to be activated? If they were, what could 20 to 30,000 highly trained, highly, you know, integrated into our society people do? I mean, what could you pull off? People with 30,000 soldiers plus, you know, a million collaborators here in the United States. I don't think it's a guarantee that we won't experience that, because the whole plan is to build up Israel as a hegemony and remove the necessity of relying on America. So what would be the reason they would want to keep us around? Here's this woman. Again, I wish I knew her name, but I think she's exactly right about what she sees coming down the pipe. Let's watch.
In fucking Hawaii, all of the fucking signs are there. They're jumping ship because they got out of the United States what they fucking wanted, and now they do not care what happens to you. Larry Fink, king of fucking Zionists and owner of BlackRock, went on national fucking television. Do you know what BlackRock owns? Your fucking mortgages, your savings account, every bank you bank with, your Roth IRA, your 401k. And when they said, well, we ran out of tax dollars to spend on developing the infrastructure to maintain the AI surveillance centers, so we're going to use your savings accounts and your retirement funds to build that so we have the technology and ease we need to hunt you down and put you in detention centers. Your tax dollars built the detention centers, and your retirement is building the AI surveillance software they need to hunt you the down. Say I'm being dramatic, but the IDF is already here on American soil collecting a paycheck working for ICE. We have confirmation that IDF soldiers were in Chicago, Illinois when ICE was doing its operations. We have confirmation that IDF soldiers are presently working in Delaney, New Jersey. Former ICE agents have already confirmed that they were trained by IDF soldiers on how to use AI surveillance to hunt down specific immigrant target. They are already here, and they have every tool they need to genocide you. They wrote a manifesto about how they intend on doing it, and in the coming days, they are voting to bring the people over to do it. We do not have the luxury to disagree about politics. We do not have the luxury to be Democrats or Republicans. The threat to American soil is presently operating on American soil, getting paid by your tax dollars and your retirement funds. If you are not planning your rebellion, then you need to be planning your departure. It is fight or flight, and not another moment can be spent arguing about this. We have to rip Donald Trump, his entire administration, AIPAC, and all of Israel out of the United States of America, root and stem, because when they are done here, they will come for the world.
Yeah, I think she's right. I think she's right. And it sucks because Donald Trump was the one dude that was equipped to free America from these foreign interventions, and instead he has gone all in on them, and he's sold out America. He's liquidated us. Follow us on rumble.com/thewarroomlive. That's rumble.com/thewarroomlive. That's the primary feed. Of course, follow us on X. I'm at Harrison H. Smith. Follow us at AJ in live, at AJ in live, at Real Alex Jones. We've got a lot of other videos that just happened to, hey, look, you know, maybe I am the crazy one. Maybe all these things have nothing to do with each other. Maybe they're all totally different. And I'm the crazy one drawing red strings between the totally disparate events, but I can't help it. But I can't help but notice how these things are going. And I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to be proven wrong. But the thing is, it's like, if you assume that all of these things happening and all of these people engaged in it do not have your best interests in mind, and in fact are trying to kill you, and they have to resist them with everything that you've got, if you operate with that as an assumption, the worst possible thing is that they weren't trying to kill you after all, and you know, you just like made yourself powerful even though you didn't really need to. Whoops. Oh, well, worst of the worst. If that is true, but you don't act like it's true, if you ignore this rising situation, then you die. Then everything is gone and everything gets destroyed. So it's kind of like, even if this isn't what they're doing, we can't take the risk. It's not worth the gamble. It's not worth the gamble to just assume that all of these things going into place that look an awful lot like a giant digital panopticon prison planet, Zionist hell world. Yeah, you know, maybe it's all an accident. Maybe it's all a coincidence. Maybe everything's fine. But I'm not willing to take that risk, and neither should you. It's the same argument I had about like QAnon with the QAnon people about Trump, where they were like, "Don't worry about it. Everything's under control. Hillary's in Guantanamo already," or whatever. And it's like, okay, if you operate as if that's true, then you're going to be screwed if you're wrong. If you operate as if that's not true and it is true, it's fine. Do you see what I'm saying? That like, you have to operate as if the attack really is coming. You have to operate as if this isn't a coincidence, that these are all related, that this is all interconnected, that it is a giant attack. Consequences of being wrong in that situation aren't that bad. The consequences of being wrong and ignoring it and not thinking it's happening and you're wrong about that, then it's hard to explain. It's hard to verbalize, but I think you get what I'm saying. If you don't, maybe your IQ is not high enough to be here because it's pretty. I think it's pretty clear what I'm trying to get across. And I didn't go around looking for videos today to bolster my argument that everything we see going on is all about creating a giant Zionist-controlled control grid. And again, the thing is, there was a tweet one time. It was a drop-down choice poll people were holding on Twitter. And it said, who do you think is right? Do you think Alex Jones is right, that it's the World Economic Forum? Do you think Nick Fuentes is right, that it's the Jews? Do you think that somebody else is right, that it's the Chinese? It all seemed pretty simple to me because it's all of it together, right? It's the World Economic Forum as the managing structure, forcing this stuff onto national governments all throughout the West. China developed, devised, and really perfected the social credit system that's being exported out to everybody else. And once the global Chinese-style social credit score control grid is in place, it'll be managed out of a super state in Israel that will serve as the capital of the one world government. It's all of this combined. And again, it really doesn't seem that complicated to me. But people, I guess, want an even simpler answer. It's really not even that complicated. Let's go to clip 14 here. This is Donald Trump. I assume this was today. Maybe it was a month ago. Who knows? Who cares? Because we're in Groundhog's Day, and we just keep experiencing the same thing over and over and over. So here's Donald Trump admitting yet again that, yeah, we got into war with Iran because of Israel, as if anybody needed to be told this. It's good to hear it confirmed for the 1,000th time. Let's watch.
It is separate, but Israel, they've been a great partner. Bibi Netanyahu has been, for me, a great partner. For other people, not so good. For me, he's been very good. We were very effective, what we've done, and they needed us. They couldn't have done it without us, couldn't have even come close, and they needed us, and they got us to help them with a real problem, because Iran was a real problem, a big problem, a worldwide problem.
For them. It was a problem for them. It wasn't a problem for us. Trump's like, he's been a great partner for me, not so much for other people, like the American people, like the rest of us. Again, yeah, I don't, it is just like Groundhog's Day, but like, it's so inexplicable. What is this devotion to Netanyahu? What is this? He's the worst. And it's like every week, Donald Trump has to go out of his way. The metaphors I'm thinking are not fit for radio airwaves. To kneel before him, to kneel before Benjamin Netanyahu, even if he doesn't have to. It's just like nobody's talking about Benjamin Netanyahu, and Trump just like kicks the door down and is like, I want Netanyahu pardoned by the president of Israel because he's a genius and a war hero and he's the best. And we're just like, Jesus, sir, this is a Wendy's. Please calm down. What is this devotion to Netanyahu? Who is this guy? He's some dude that grew up in Philadelphia, changed his name from some Polish nonsense to something that sounds more Hebrew. Like, why is he allowed to do literally anything that he's doing? Why is he writing letters to our congressmen saying, thank you for adopting my proposal to merge the Israeli and American governments? This is like so inexplicable, cultish, bizarre, and pathetic, and just pathetic. I mean, genuinely, who likes Netanyahu? Who likes him? If you were to hold a poll of Americans, you're like, what do you think about Benjamin Netanyahu? I think the only thing people would like about him is the fact that he gets stuff done for his country. They'd be like, yeah, I like him because he is a model of how statesmen should be, because he clearly ruthlessly values his own country over everybody else and does whatever's necessary to benefit himself and his country. I don't know. I just don't know, man. I cannot wrap my mind around what is motivating Donald Trump. It is genuinely crazy. Netanyahu was the first world leader to congratulate Joe Biden. He was the first one. So I just don't know what to make of it anymore. But this is the poison that we're stuck with. And for some reason, it's like everybody in our government worships the ground Benjamin Netanyahu walks on. And he's basically worse than Hitler. So do you feel insane yet? Because that's the consequence of having these people run your society, is you feel insane because they are all insane and the most ridiculous liars you've ever encountered. And yet their control is so ubiquitous, it makes you feel like the crazy one for noticing. Let's go to clip 11 here. GOP Representative Marlon Stutzman met with Netanyahu in Jerusalem last week to hand deliver him a draft resolution. And all I want is to live in a country where obvious treason is treated as such, where we have politicians who actually like our country more than other countries. Is that so much to ask? Like, I feel like I'm going insane. There are people that walk around the Capitol building asking everyone they meet, America first or Israel first. 90% of the time, people won't even answer. Well, actually, it's like 50% of the time they won't answer. 20% of the time they say Israel. And then the rest of the time they'll say America. But will they? But I might even be over guessing it. I mean, for the most part, they refuse to say. Which really tells you, like, where we are in this country. We are colonized subjects of a foreign state of 10 million people. Let's go to clip 11 here. This is GOP Rep. Marlon Stutzman. Again, just slobbering over Israel and Netanyahu in the most pathetic display I've ever seen. Let's watch.
Congressman, you actually met with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Jerusalem last week, and you provided him with a draft House resolution that would end U.S. financial military aid to Israel. Tell us more about your proposal and how the Prime Minister viewed it.
Yeah, so we had a great meeting. I tell you, the relationship between the United States and Israel is stronger than ever. In fact, you know, I often ask people, who is the greatest ally of the United States? You know, we used to say it would be Great Britain, but these days it's Israel. And they have grown so much, 10 million people. Their GDP is growing towards $1 trillion. And this was actually something that came from Prime Minister Netanyahu's conversation with 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago, when he said that the next MOU with the United States and Israel, he would like to see us move away from the $3.8 billion annual supplement that we send to Israel. Now, you know, does this end anti-Semitism? I doubt it. Does it create more conspiracy theories? Probably. But this is real. This is a maturing relationship, and we've been calling it aid to trade, moving from an aid supplement to a trade agreement, to defense agreements, and a real mature partnership, because Israel has grown tremendously and their abilities and capabilities are incredible. And so he was very open and excited to see the resolution. I filed it today here in the House of Representatives, and we just want to show President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu that Congress would support moving this direction.
Thanks, Goy Stutzman. You absolute dumbass. Netanyahu has made the case for relationship must change from old partnership. It's so funny. They asked, they're like, you presented this idea to Netanyahu. How did he react to it? Meanwhile, Netanyahu is writing letters to Representative Stutzman saying, thank you for adopting my plan. It's like, at least get your story straight. Again, what are you supposed to say? It really is just pure unrelenting insanity, because none of it is even remotely moored to reality at all. There's no touchstone to reality. We just heard Donald Trump talk about how There's no way Israel could do anything that it needed to do, that it was desperate and we had to go help. First of all, admitting, obviously, that the Iran war was for the benefit of Israel and for the sake of Israel and at the behest of Israel, like we've known the entire time. But also, obviously, contradicting whatever that dumbass just said about Israel's, oh, they're the incredible power that they have. Now, they're our greatest ally, really, because they provide us nothing. They give us nothing. We benefit nothing from them. We give them everything. They can't survive without us. We ruin our reputation. Our soldiers die for their behalf. What makes them a good ally? Their democracy in the Middle East. Are they? That might be the best example. They're the only democracy in the Middle East. They're not a democracy, and they're not the only one in the Middle East. It literally makes no sense. It literally makes no sense. Of course he gets money from AIPAC. I mean, that's a tiny amount. Marl Stutzman. Marl Stutzman's soul is worth $48,000, apparently. This is what I mean. None of it ever makes any sense. And they know that it doesn't make any sense, which is why it makes everybody feel crazy. We obviously went to war with Iran. They'll tell you totally straight face, you're a crazy anti-Semite for saying that. They will simultaneously hold a Republican Jewish coalition events where they say in no uncertain words, we got rid of Thomas Massie. That's what you get for messing with us. That's what you get for questioning us. The Jewish people ousted Thomas Massie because it was Israel. At the exact same time, Ben Shapiro is saying that's the stupidest thing he's ever heard, and anybody that believes that is an anti-Semite. Does it make you feel crazy yet? Because they know what they're doing. Do you think Ben Shapiro actually thought Thomas Massie was ousted because of his opposition to the Big Beautiful Bill? Do you think that? They know. They know exactly what they're doing. So we go to war for Israel. We fund everything about Israel. In exchange for this, they provide us nothing. They destroy our country. The incredible power they wield here in America is never, never used to benefit the American people, ever. And yes, I'm talking about the Israelis and the American Jews and all of their incredible power, the ADL and AIPAC and the SPLC and all of these groups with their inordinate authority over our country, with their infinite wealth to shape political conversations and debates. When has a single Jewish organization ever put money towards, I don't know, ousting a Soros DA? Or just, I mean, literally pick anything, pick literally anything. What has the benefit been ever for this partnership for America? And if our partnership, if this, you know, little relationship we have with this disgusting little cancer spot of Eastern European transplants, the genocidal psychopaths in Israel, if all it was us paying their way, if all it was us dying for their sake, destroying our country, destroying our economy, destroying our standing in the world, undercutting all of our demands from the Trump administration and mass deportations or anything else that would actually tangibly benefit this country, it all gets subsumed, it all gets thrown to the side for the benefit of the Israelis. And if in exchange they had even a modicum of gratitude, if in exchange they said, thank you for all of this, this is incredible, how can we help, what can we do for you, maybe it would be manageable. Maybe it would be able to be endured without too much anger. But it is the fact that we give everything to them and they turn around and say, we're the bad guys for not giving more. They demand that we tie ourselves to an even greater degree to them. Screw these people. Screw this country. Screw Netanyahu. Screw Representative Saltzman, whatever the hell his name is. They're all traitors to this country. They're all engaged in the liquidation of this country and the selling out of your children's future for their own benefit. and to have the balls to then turn around and act like they're doing something for us, like this is a benefit for us. And again, I'll just say, I mean, Donald Trump could have been the guy. He could have been the one. What's going to happen instead? What's going to happen instead is that the Israelis took over the Trump administration, meaning they took over the Republican Party, meaning they took over America. They're now using the strength and power of America to progress their own agenda, to destroy the people of America, to make our lives more miserable, but to benefit themselves. They send America to war with Iran, a war that was always going to have massive negative consequences economically, that was always going to be a pointless endeavor without American boots on the ground. The goal was always to get American boots on the ground because the goal was always to use their position in control of America to grind America into the dust fighting their enemies. That was always the plan. It's the same plan they're running with the Republican Party. They took over the Republican Party. They turned it towards Israel first and Israel only. You have people like Alan frickin' Dershowitz, Jeffrey Epstein's bosom buddy, switching over to the Republicans and saying, I'm still a Democrat. I still believe in all of the Democratic things I've always believed, but I'm a Republican because I'm pro-Israel now. Meanwhile, Thomas Massie, a founding father reborn, gets kicked out of the Republican Party because he's not sufficiently pro-Israel. So the Republican Party has been taken over completely by the Israeli lobby, which means they're going to go down in flames in the next election and the election after that. Meaning that our good friends, the Israelis and the diaspora Jews here in America, who are more loyal to Israel than they are to America, have just set up the Republican Party to be absolutely viciously defeated in the ballot box, but not before Donald Trump pretends to do a bunch of stuff, offends them, outrages them, and sets the stage for them to take vengeance on not just Trump, but his supporters as well. Trump will probably be in Israel when all of this goes down, but the Democrats will get into power. They will dominate the Senate, the Congress. They'll probably pack the Supreme Court, and they will institute the most egregious and dangerous oppression that certainly America has ever seen. And it's going to get really bad. And it might get super violent. And that might be the perfect time for people like the founder of the Tikva Fund or Jonathan Greenblatt himself to really make the case they've been making that, you know, Israel's the place for Jews. You know, you Jewish Americans, you don't want to be in America. Look how dangerous it is with these radical Democrats in charge running around. Gee, it looks like you better come seek safety with us here in Israel, as America, as they put it, is the dying empire. And you're going to want to come over to the rising empire in Israel. And you're going to want to take your money with you as well. You're going to want to start that feedback loop as you withdraw money from the American economy. The American economy standing goes down and it's harder to get money, and that feedback loop will continue at a pace. Do you not think this is the plan? And do you not know that they're already building to a massive communist revolution on May 1st, 2028? All these plans are in place. They're all just rolling out right in front of you. They're spiking the Republican Party. They're making it so the Democrats sweep into victory and have total power to do whatever the hell they want to the American people, to legalize all the immigrants, to actually, you know, charge Trump supporters with terrorism. Oh, they're not going to need a January 6th this time. They're just going to do it. They keep saying they're doing it. They're going to do it. Listen to anybody in the Democratic Party that speaks honestly, and they all say, yeah, we're going to round up Trump supporters when we're in office. They're not joking. They're going to go after, you know, police officers, ICE agents. And they're going to launch a communist revolution on May 1st, 2028, by having every major labor union in the country go on strike all at the same time. It's the play they ran in 1848. It's the play that they're currently running in Bolivia. Do you know that Bolivia has been in a countrywide strike for the last 4 weeks? Did you know that? You didn't. Why weren't you told? Because they're going to do it here. They're practicing in Bolivia. I'll tell you about that on the other side. I don't know about you, but I, for one, was totally unaware that Bolivia, country in South America, had been basically frozen for the last several weeks as massive coordinated strikes have shut down the entire country. Have you heard about this? It's not been a major news story here. I really hadn't heard anything about it. I can't help but see it as a practice run for what we know is going to happen in 2028. So we've shown the videos, we've shown the articles. Maybe we need to have Carlin back on, Carlin Borishenko, because she is another person who's noticed that they're planning this and is making noise about it. But essentially, the UAW union, which is the largest labor union in America, is acting as the spearhead, but they're getting all of the other labor unions in America to design their contracts so they all expire on May 1st, 2028. So come May 1st, 2028, their plan, as stated by them, like this is their announced intentions, is they are going to have an indefinite, permanent strike until they get their demands. Their demands include universal health care, universal basic income. It's communism. It's basic communism or, you know, very far down the road socialism. And they're saying they're going to do this, and they are going to do it, and they have the power to do it. And nobody is stopping them. So they're going to do this. They're going to do this on May 1st, 2028. They're going to bring the economy of America to a screeching halt. And they're going to demand constitutional changes to our government if we want to have an economy. And it's point by point, step by step, exactly what's happening in Bolivia as we speak. And nobody's reporting on it. And I can't help but think that nobody's reporting on it because they don't want you to know what the plan is. They want this to happen in Bolivia. They can test the reaction. They can test the, you know, stress test the operation in a small country that doesn't have a big geopolitical impact. They'll work out the kinks and then they'll do it here. And they do this. They did the same thing with Brazil and America in terms of stealing the election. But maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe it's just a big coincidence that we know that labor unions in America are planning this protest on May 1st, 2028. And it just so happens that on May 1st, 2026, the Bolivian unions do exactly the same thing. So imagine America experiencing this, because we're about to, if we don't stop it. From Reuters, what is behind Bolivia's widening protest? This was from May 18th, 2 weeks ago, right? And it had already been going on for 2 weeks at that point. So Bolivia's been basically shut down and like in a state of open rebellion for the last month, and nobody in America has reported on it. Supporters of Bolivia's former leftist president, Evo Morales, marched through La Paz on Monday, the 18th, widening unrest that has blocked roads for nearly 2 weeks and triggered shortages of food, fuel, and medical supplies across the country. The disruptions have stranded trucks on highways and left patients unable to reach hospitals, authorities said. Argentina sent a military aircraft with food supplies at Bolivia's request. Demonstrations began with strikes in early March, or early May, rather. They've grown into a nationwide movement involving labor unions, miners, transport workers, and rural groups. Protesters are pressing President Rodrigo Paz's government to roll back austerity measures and address rising living costs, with some calling for his resignation. Analysts say the unrest has broadened from local grievances to wider anti-government sentiment over the country's economic direction. What are the main grievances? The protests centered on rising economic pressures. Teachers are demanding higher pay and more funding, while transport unions have launched open-ended strikes amid fuel shortages and supply concerns. Indigenous and rural groups oppose agrarian reforms they say favor larger landowners. Despite the government repealing a controversial agrarian law this month, protests have continued. Paz, who took office in November and inherited an economy in turmoil, has defended spending cuts and fuel subsidy reductions as necessary to stabilize public finances. He's preparing a reform package for Congress that includes gradually lifting fuel price controls and measures to boost domestic energy production and investment. The government has sought to ease tensions through negotiations and wage increases while deploying around 3,500 security forces to clear roadblocks. Authorities say about 57 people have been arrested. So again, an open-ended strike, a strike for which there is no easy solution, a strike which involves every major labor union in the country simultaneously going on strike in an attempt to get major concessions for the, you know, former socialist president Morales. Bolivia's capital under siege as protests deepen crisis for President Paz. Again, all the way back in May, on May 19th. Why haven't you heard about this? Why has nobody been reporting on this? Bolivia's trade unions demand president's resignation amid ongoing general strike. So this was May 30th, just a few days ago. Amid ongoing rebellion against the neoliberal model, the Trade Union Federation, Bolivia's Workers Central, issued a strong statement addressed to President Paz. The statement demanded Paz's resignation and called on popular sector to remain in the streets until they can defeat attempts to restore the neocolonial state. The COB issued the statement through Bolivian community media on Thursday, May 28th. In it, the union addressed the president, saying, "Enough of your lies, enough of deceiving the Bolivian people." Meanwhile, 77 roadblocks remained in six of the country's departments on the 28th day of protest. Yeah, it's coming here, folks. This is going to come here. And if we can, I don't know if y'all have my screen exactly, but I want to just go through some of these. Major protests continue across Bolivia as demonstrators demand the resignation of President Luis Arce, citing economic turmoil. I think that's wrong, right? President Paz. Fuel shortages and growing frustration with his government's handling of the country's crisis. This was from 2 days ago. You can, you know, it's still going strong. But this is what it's been like. Major protests continue across Bolivia. Even as today, rural workers in Bolivia have seized an oil field in the Santa Cruz region and halted all production as part of a general strike against neoliberalism. The site in the Santa Rosa El Cerro municipality is now fully offline. That was of June 30th. Did you know this? Like, you would think this would be kind of important, that there's massive nationwide protests all across Bolivia and that the protesters are actively taking over oil fields and shutting down the production. That seems like kind of a big deal. Thousands of Bolivian miners and workers joined together against the regime of Rodrigo Paz, a puppet of the United States, they say, which seeks to hand over the resources and privatize the country to deliver it to the empire. Imperialism wants Bolivia to become another Argentina. The people said enough and are fighting to prevent it. This, of course, is the exact, story they'll tell Americans as well. I think they're right. I don't exactly think they're wrong, but I think they're on both sides of this. Like, do you understand? This is why I constantly refer to like that JFK speech where he talks about, hey, you should have paid Karl Marx a little better. He never would have written the Communist Manifesto, or the, you know, contented workman ad from the 40s that says, hey, you know, the contented workman, the person who's paid well and respected, they got no love for communism. They got no need for communism. You need both. You need the ruthless capitalist exploitation to cause the anger and the outrage and the discontent that the communists can then take advantage of. You need both. You can't have one or the other, right? You need the quote-unquote capitalist, the ruthless industrialist, to abuse the people so that the communists have fertile ground to plant their seeds. Like, don't think for a single second that this is a fight against, you know, capitalism and communism. They are working hand in hand to destroy populations and take over countries. And it goes on. This is from May 19th. Bolivia is descending into chaos with protesters demanding Rodrigo Paz resign just 6 months into his term. Riots, clashes with police, and looting have broken out in La Paz as miners, indigenous groups, and unions take to the streets. Protesters have taken an oil production facility near Santa Cruz, the economic and conservative heart of the country. This is on the same day that Paz calls on security forces to destroy blockades. The U.S. also usually gets involved when oil production is affected. This is from June 3rd. Bolivia is facing its most serious political unrest in years as protests over low wages, inflation, and economic reforms spread across La Paz. Demonstrators have confronted police and blocked roads from May 26th. And from June 2nd, the protest in Bolivia has reached 1 month and is spreading with more than 90 roadblocks causing shortages in La Paz. So once again, this was not a spontaneous reaction to austerity measures. This was a planned, coordinated uprising sponsored and managed by the labor unions in the country with the purpose of overthrowing the legitimately elected government and installing a permanent communist rule. And once again, I'll say the reason you don't know about this, the reason this is not being covered, is because this is the practice run for what they're going to do in America in 2028. This is it. This is their plan. This is exactly what they plan on doing. Now, think about the riots and the chaos that we've experienced just over the last year at ICE facilities or Black Lives Matter in 2020. I mean, think about that being a, for the most part, totally decentralized and in many cases, you know, spontaneous uprising. Now imagine it's being coordinated by every major labor union in the country. U.S. Defense Secretary compares Bolivia protest to government overthrow. You know, maybe it's all a coincidence. Maybe it's just a coincidence that they happen to be running the exact playbook that they'll be running here in 2 years. And I really, you know, again, as you look at all of this, it really does seem like all of this is building up towards that, that you're going to have this ultimate culmination of this, of these massive riots, the massive chaos, if we even make it that far, because I also am seeing a lot of signs that there's going to be some sort of major attack at the World Cup. You know, the most obvious one is these people in New York emerging out of the manholes, manhole covers that nobody can identify who they are, the mystery people, that the most surveilled city in the world, New York City, the most well-funded police department in the world. You know, the New York Police Department is like the third largest army in the world or something ridiculous. They have more manpower and money than you could ever possibly use, but they can't figure out who these people are, who these teams of people going into the underground in New York for mysterious reasons. Groups of people. Again, you get one guy going in a manhole, that guy might be crazy. When you have 10 people getting into a manhole, getting out, having pre-staged cars and clothes to change into, this is an operation being carried out. And I keep saying that if there's going to be a false flag pulled off, it's going to have to be absolutely massive. What better event to do that than the World Cup? Take 9/11 and make it worldwide. You know, demolish a stadium while a game is being played. I mean, God only knows. But it's another example of, like, I think something's happening here. I think there's not as much concern as there should be for where all of this is headed. I got, again, more videos to back all this up. Let's go to clip 13 here. This is Ro Khanna on the floor of Congress. And he actually, and you know, this is one of the things where the Democrats are the only ones standing up against this. Ro Khanna and another Democrat have now sponsored a bill to strip Section 224 out of the NDAA, which is great, and that should happen. The Republicans in our country only serve Israel. That's where we're at this point. One of the other things that happened today that I haven't covered yet, or yesterday, is the fact that the weaponization fund that was supposed to go towards everybody persecuted by the Biden Justice Department, it no longer exists. They've gotten rid of the weaponization fund. It was supposed to be $1.8 billion provided to victims of Joe Biden's Justice Department, the January Sixers, or us, right? People, organizations who unfairly were persecuted by the Biden Justice Department, were actually going to get a payout for this. This happens all the time on the left, all the time, in instances where it never should happen. The most obvious one would be the Black Lives Matter riots, where they burnt entire cities down, and yet the people that were engaged in those riots were then later given $20,000 to $30,000 a piece from the city because they said they were abused by the cops and that their arrest was illegitimate. So they participate in a, you know, arson attack. They get put in zip ties for 30 minutes. New York City and Philadelphia hands them a $20,000, $30,000 check apiece. This happens all the time on the left. For once, it was about to happen for the right, because we actually are victims of government overreach. We actually do have a case for reparations in what the illegitimate actions of the Biden government cost us, did to us, personal damage. People like Stuart Rhodes, life destroyed, stuck in a jail cell. People like I mean, any of the January 6ers, but especially the more prominent ones, like the QAnon shaman, American shaman, who spent like 6 months in solitary confinement. He deserves reparations. He deserves payback. We all saw the video. He was given a tour through the Capitol by police officers. He was walking next to police officers the entire time, and the minute Donald Trump said to go home, he got on the bullhorn and told everybody to go home. They put him in solitary confinement for 6 months. You don't think he deserves a little bit of a payout? A little bit of something to deal with the suffering that he has been subjected to, the lifelong consequences of the mental attack against him for 6 months? Do you know why we're not getting the weaponization fund? Because the Senate Republicans shut it down. The Republican Party, who just gave like $100 billion to fight a war for Israel against Iran, can't spare $1.8 billion for their own constituents who actually experienced brutal persecution by the Biden administration. It was the Republican Party that shut that down. The Republican Party decided to suddenly remember their fiscal responsibility, not when it's war with Iran, not when it's a $1.5 trillion military budget. That gets passed through with flying colors and give it all over to Israel while we're at it with Section 224. But your voters, your constituency, the people you're supposed to represent might accidentally experience a windfall, experience appropriate reparations for the massive, you know, emotional scarring and financial damage that was done to them by the Biden administration. Here come the Republicans to shut that down and make sure that we cannot ever benefit from them being in power. It never happens. The Democrats, they understand the way the game is played. The Democrats get into office and they create NGOs. They start funding their own little pet projects. They start handing out big gift packages to every, you know, ethnic minority that helped to get them elected. They reward their patrons. Republicans get shafted every single time. Every single time. And again, I just want to say, it's not just like retarded the way these Republicans treat their own people. The occasional time they actually decide to be concerned about the budget, it's only when it could possibly benefit you, then they'll come in and swoop in and stop it. But it's like, even if it was for their own self-aggrandizement, even if it was for their own power, even if it was totally a selfish maneuver by them, tactically, strategically, if they want to retain power, if they want to stay in office, wouldn't you want to reward your people? Like, it doesn't make sense on any level, on any level. And it's not even a principled stand anyway, like you're stopping government waste. This isn't waste. This is an appropriate settlement for the misbehavior of the Biden administration that these Republicans utterly failed to stop in the first place. So you tell me, give me a single damn reason to vote for Republicans this time around. They're the ones that got us into war. They're the ones that shut down the weaponization fund. They're the ones that are tying us ever closer to Israel. It's just, we do not have to take this. We do not have to put up with this. We, the American people, do not have to just sit back and allow these people to screw us every single time. And at least in this instance, I'd say God bless the Democrats and Ro Khanna in particular for standing up against the takeover of America by this hostile foreign nation, Israel. Let's watch.
American people are tired of the arrogance and insolence of Prime Minister Netanyahu telling America what we should do. The entire country of Israel has a GDP that is less than a single town in my district. Yet somehow Netanyahu thinks he could tell the American people what we should do. The person who's most upset with him right now is President Donald Trump. And everyone in America, whether you're a Republican, an independent, or a Democrat, says that we need to tell Netanyahu that America calls the shots, not the prime minister of any other country. They want less cooperation and blank checks to Israel, not more. Only the United States Congress would dream up at this moment, let's actually do more for Israel, not less. And that's what Section 2024 does. It's a pretty simple thing. Should we do more for Israel than we already do, or should we do less? If you think we should do more for Israel, you should be against my amendment. If you think we should do less for Israel at the time that he's arrogantly telling Donald Trump what to do, then you should be for my amendment. Now, let me just be clear. Mr. Netanyahu actually wrote to a member of Congress to put this Section 224 into the bill.
Yeah, great. Good thing we got Ro Khanna there. Put up some defense to this. House Committee blocks effort to strip U.S.-Israel cooperation provision from annual defense bill. So it's moving forward. It's moving forward regardless. It's moving forward no matter what. Let's go to clip 18 here. This is U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Mike Waltz, who, I remind you, was caught feeding information to Netanyahu to undermine Donald Trump. His punishment for that was to be appointed U.N. ambassador. It's called Jewish privilege. Let's watch.
The U.N. has been and is a cesspool of anti-Semitism, and under President Trump, there is no more turning a blind eye, period. We are going to use our voice, our vote, our money, and what leverage we have. So, you know, I won't elaborate on too much of what you see out there, but what I do want to tell you is what we're doing about it. Well, number one, anti-Semites that call Israel a stain on humanity, like Francesca Albanese, are now sanctioned. Number two, organizations like UNESCO, we've backed out of, we're no longer funding. UNRWA, we are going to dismantle and are in the process. The so-called Human Rights Council that has the likes of China, Cuba, Venezuela, and others on it, we are no longer participating in. And I think most importantly, on the Security Council, we have vetoed time and time again, six resolutions by my count just since October 7th, measures that are completely, absolutely, and only targeted towards our best, and I would say, and absolutely the most democratic ally, the only democratic ally in the Middle East, Israel. So we are using our money, we are using our voice, we are using our vote, and we are going to take this on and fight and block and tackle at every turn, period. And this is only because of President Donald J. Trump's leadership. That is just indisputable.
U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Yeah, that was you. That was the U.S. ambassador. I know it's kind of confusing because he literally is talking the entire time there about Israel and benefiting Israel. But this is the arrangement, right? They get to use our power. They get to use the American government's authority. They get to use our prosperity and our position in the world to benefit themselves, not America. Nothing he just described had anything to do with America. He's talking about putting sanctions on a UN special rapporteur for accurately reporting what Israel's doing in Gaza. He's talking about using America's vote to protect Israel from sanctions by the UN. He's talking about using America's power, wealth, influence, using all of it for their ends, to their benefit. That's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. literally giving a 5-minute speech about how everything he's doing is in service of Israel and even taking on the U.N. just to benefit, again, this genocidal little psychopathic state. So Mike Waltz and everyone like him needs to be forcibly expelled from the United States. That's my position at this point. Stripped of power is one thing, but I don't want him here. These people don't deserve to be here. He got caught committing treason against the President of the United States. His punishment was to go to the UN to represent Israel under the name of the United States. Screw this system. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is War Room Live. I'm your host, Harrison Smith, AlexJonesLive.com, the Alex Jones Network. Right now, there is a absolutely massive discount on every single product at thealexjonesstore.com. Go to thealexjonesstore.com today. From now until Friday at midnight, you're getting 40 to 50% off site-wide. Half off every product, pretty much. 40 to 50% off site-wide sale. No discount code needed. That ends Friday at midnight. Plus, this is your last week. In fact, it's your final 2 days to enter to win both the custom H1 Hummer and the 2026 Dodge Charger, plus $20,000 in cash. For every $1 you spend, you get 100 times the entries to win both. And this is the week where people most often win the car. And we've given a lot of these cars away. We got to give these to somebody. Somebody's got to win these cars. Might as well be you, right? All you got to do is go to thealexjonesstore.com to be entered to win. Spend a dollar, get 100 times entries to win. Plus, if you spend $99, you get free shipping. Spend $125, you get free CMOS gummies. Spend $175, you get free Shilajit gummies, plus the CMOS, plus the free shipping. Plus, it's all 40 to 50% off site-wide until midnight tomorrow. But don't wait. Go now to thealexjonesstore.com. Support us. Keep us on the air and get the best products in the world at half off today and tomorrow only at thealexjonesstore.com. The Carmelo Anthony trial is occurring here in Texas, and we're getting a lot of updates. Apparently, the jury has now seen the surveillance footage, and I'll go to a description of that in just a second. Before we do, I want to go to clip 25 here. This is Savannah Hernandez, who's there at the trial, talking about jury selection and some manipulation, perhaps, going on from the defense. Let's watch.
Okay, also, I just noticed this headline, baby-faced Carmelo Anthony heads to court to stand trial for murder. Now, one thing that I forgot to report to you guys yesterday, because I did get to go inside the courthouse and I was watching the live stream of the jury selection, is that Carmelo Anthony has since shaved his head, so he even looks younger than he does in this photo. On top of that, let's not forget that his lawyer is going to be referring to him for the duration of this trial as Mello, a nickname that his lawyer states his friends and family know him by. So not only has Carmelo drastically changed his appearance with that shaved head, again, making him look much younger, but his lawyer also going to be referring to him as Mello for the duration of this trial. By the way, you have the Carmelo supporters, which I'm sure you can hear behind me. They were just chanting that they love their black youth and they deserve protection too. I am live on the ground for opening arguments of the Carmelo Anthony trial.
So those opening arguments happened today, and some evidence was presented, including the video of the event at the track meet. We have a report from somebody that was in the courtroom and saw the video themselves. And it sounds like it's not quite the clear-cut, you know, solution-providing video that it may otherwise be. He stabbed, she stabbed. Yeah, pretty much. Let's go to clip 27 now.
Country, but those opening statements were definitely powerful on either side.
Notes, Cody. We're so fortunate that you've been able to share with us what is happening inside of that courtroom. Tell us more about the surveillance video, because your notes on this were very interesting. What were you able to see? And then I also understand there was a reaction from the victim's family when that was being played.
Yeah, Julia. So that's in the opening statement, they were referencing surveillance video. And, you know, of course, everyone wanted to see video. We haven't seen anything. There's been a gag order on this case since the very beginning last year. So they start playing this video. There are five different angles of the video getting walked through from testimony by the forensic video analyst. And they were very wide angle videos, Julia. And the witness had to talk about how he had to use his software to zoom in and try to make the video as clear as possible. And even then, Julia, I won't lie, it still looked very fuzzy and hazy. It definitely sets the scene. You can see what's going on, but even the prosecution distinctly said that you won't be able to uniquely identify anyone, but they referred to Carmelo on the video as the person of interest, and they referred to Austin Metcalf as the victim. Of course, as the forensic analyst has digested this video and dissected it and pointed out everything that we need to know, going through shoes and the type of clothing they were wearing. So we identified who each person was in the video, even though they kind of just looked like humanoid blobs. But you see, one thing that stood out to me, Julie, is that, you know, I'm very familiar with track meets. I was under the impression that, you know, when you go to a championship track meet, you have multiple tents on the same side of the bleachers. But in this video, because it's early in the morning, just before 10 a.m. when all this happened, the tent where all this went down, Memorial High School, it was just an isolated tent in the bleachers by itself. There were no surrounding, schools or anything in the general area. You saw some schools walking in, but I guess, you know, the meet was just starting. But anyway, they identified Carmelo walking up the bleachers, kind of walking towards the tent. He kind of goes towards someone, and you see him standing there for a couple of minutes. Then you see Austin Metcalf, his twin brother, and his friends walking up and getting under the tent. And then once everything's happening under the tent, it just kind of looks like a blob of people. You can't really make out anything that's really going on for 5 to 6 minutes. And then you see a quick to and from. You know, and they were implying that was like the push, the initial contact. You can't really see anything happening. Before then, you see people walking by. They're not really, you know, turning heads as if something's loud and, you know, something's catching their attention. But all of a sudden, you see that to and from, and then you see Carmelo, or who they identify as person of interest, who we're assuming to be Carmelo Anthony. He runs out from under the tent, and then he's running down the bleachers, sprinting a ways away from the tent and out of the stadium, onto the track and everything, towards one of his coaches. And eventually after that, we see another angle of the video where Carmelo's been taken into custody by police. But the reaction, Julia, it wasn't a visceral reaction. You know, when you saw the to and from, of course, that's the stabbing action, if you will. All I saw, I'm sitting two rows behind Austin Metcalf's father, and his head was just kind of in his hands, kind of like this. Wasn't necessarily crying, but, you know, just implying that he doesn't really want to see, even though he can't see the stabbing, but he knows in his mind this is the moment that his son lost his life. So he was just there, you know, obviously overwhelmed by everything. I'm sitting right behind the Metcalf family. Carmelo Anthony's family's on the opposite side of the courtroom. But again, the video, not as impactful as I thought, but it definitely is a scene setter to help us understand clearer as to what's going on, since we haven't seen anything so far in this case.
So again, we've got some more reports about what is occurring inside the courtroom. There's no cameras in there, but people are reporting, such as Marianne Martinez at Marianne Reports on X. She says new state witness Vincent Cooper, a coach at Frisco ISD, is now testifying that he was assigned to manage Carmelo Anthony after the stabbing and stop him from leaving the football stadium. Later, Cooper was asked to calm down a teammate of Austin Metcalf, who was angry about Austin stabbing. Austin's teammate, who is black, wanted to attack Anthony. "He stabbed my brother," the Black Memorial teammate said of Austin Metcalf. The teammate explained that he was on the football team with Austin and considered him family. Coach Rob Starr, the head track coach at Memorial High School, where Austin Metcalf went to school, he is testifying about track culture and how the tent was a big deal. "Each school has a tent with their name, logo on it, and kids who don't belong to that school do not go to the tents of other schools." Quote, "As far as the tent specifically, basically the tent marks your spot," Starr said. "What the tent represents is kind of like your bench. Think of it like a football or basketball bench. The tent is the safe area for your team." Starr added that the student athletes kept their belongings and valuables under the tent, and sometimes a coach is even assigned to stay at the tent to keep an eye on the belongings of the kids. "It's a big deal to keep people out from underneath your tent," Starr said. Starr explained he was going to be busy running the track event on the day of the stabbing and texted Austin Metcalf in the morning to help him step up and be a leader by helping to run the event. Starr recounting he was across the field at the concession stand when he saw commotion under the team tent and knew something had happened. He ran back across the field. "What I do see is Austin on the ground and his face is purple and he has a big hole in his chest," Starr explained, crying as he recalled the stabbing in April 2025. Starr says Hunter pointed at Carmelo Anthony and asked Starr to do something. Starr approached Anthony, who was walking very calmly with his coaches, until Starr asked him what happened. Starr raced back to Austin's side, where several coaches were praying over him. Twin brother Hunter was nearby and was hysterical. "I jumped the gate and I went to Hunter and he was hysterical. I just knelt down and prayed with him." Several members of the public are crying as court sees text Starr sent to Austin one day after he died. Ooh, brutal. Jurors are about to see the only known recording video of the Carmelo Anthony Austin Metcalf stabbing. Daily Mail has seen the video, which is recorded by a fixed camera at David Kirkconnell Stadium in Frisco, Texas, in April 2025, the day of the deadly meet. And that's what we know so far. There's been some controversy about the fact that there's no black members of the jury, which apparently, when, you know, questioning the jury members, many potential jurors said things like, "I couldn't put another brother in jail," or "He's just a kid. I'd have a hard time putting him in jail." So, frankly, in the pursuit of justice, it's probably a good thing. However, I wouldn't be surprised if that turned out to be a method by which a retrial could be demanded, even though I'm sure the process that they went through was legitimate. I'm sure you could find some leftist judge who thinks that, you know, having a non-black jury would somehow prejudice them against Carmel. I mean, it's ridiculous, but that is certainly the case. And again, I say that because I've seen the numbers. We've presented them here as well. A white defendant is something like 50% more likely to be convicted by a black jury, and the numbers reversed the other way around. Basically, it's proven out with the numbers that you are much, much less likely to get a fair and accurate result if the jury is black. And, you can come up with whatever reasons you want to apply, but I think it's pretty clear when, potential jurors are asked if they would throw somebody in jail and they say, I won't do it because I don't want to put another brother in prison, right? Literally just saying, I want to let the black person go. It's just like, okay, then you can't be a juror. Sorry, that's just not how this works. You're not capable of managing the responsibility, so you're not allowed on the jury. That's just how it goes. Another big event that is coming up, and it doesn't seem to be going well. I watched a bunch of videos about this yesterday. It's the UFC event in Washington, D.C. They're building this outdoor arena outside of the White House, and the whole thing seems like it is a giant disaster already, and I don't know how well it's going to go. Basically, everybody that pays attention to the UFC and comments on it and, is involved in it, you basically have like Dana White, who is saying that it's going to be great, but everybody else is like, what is this? I don't think this is actually such a great idea. For one thing, there's a particularly dystopian setup where they're going to have like 500 seats that are all going to be basically Trump and his friends, and whatever seats are left, they're selling for $1.5 million a piece. Okay, so it's literally going to be nothing but billionaires in the actual front row seats and the actual seats around the, octagon, the ring. Meanwhile, there's going to be 85,000 people at the Ellipse on the other side of the White House, I guess, watching on a big screen. So you're going to have a very Hunger Games-esque setup with the billionaires and the oligarchs watching the gladiatorial combat in the seats, while separated from them by a pretty good distance is going to be the hoi polloi and the crowd that gets to watch it on TV. The problem is they're doing this in Washington, D.C. in the middle of summer. So that's not going to go well. The fighters, people like Joe Rogan commented on it quite a bit, saying basically you shouldn't do anything like this in an uncontrolled environment. You've got fighters who are like training in saunas to try to acclimate themselves to the heat and the humidity that they'll be dealing with. But on top of that, you've got to light this thing for television, which means you're going to have incredibly bright lights over the whole thing, which is going to attract bugs. And there are going to be swarms of bugs messing up the entire thing. Doesn't seem like the greatest, like the most well thought out idea. And then if you hear the actual like timeline of how this came about, basically like Dana White and Trump were kind of in negotiations about it. They kind of talked about it and were floating the idea. And then Donald Trump just came out and announced it. You can actually find interviews of Dana White being like, yeah, you just came out and announced it. Like we were not ready for that. And he made all these big claims about what it was going to be. It's basically scaled way back. None of the fighters are happy about, who the fighters are that were chosen. The champion of the UFC has just been disinvited because he's anti-Israel. So that's an interesting development. I'll show you some videos about that here in a second. Sean Strickland is the, as far as I know, I don't really follow the UFC, but as far as I know, he is the UFC champion right now. And he has just been disinvited and is making videos about it and maybe holding a protest during the actual event, which would be very funny to see. I just have the feeling this is kind of going to be a disaster one way or another. Best possible outcome, it's a silly Trump rally that doesn't really matter. And it's just one aspect of the wider disappointment, not just in Donald Trump's administration overall, but in particular his handling of the 250th anniversary of America. Originally, his promise was basically a world's fair, right? A giant months-long celebration of America, unveiling new technologies and celebrating our history and, you know, all this great stuff, and it's slowly sort of wind down and winnowed down to the point where just a few days ago, Trump put out a statement saying, you know, basically nobody wants to perform at our event, so it's just going to be a Trump rally. The biggest, you know, the biggest crowd getter in the world, me, I'm going to be the star. And, you know, a lot of people had the same reaction, which was like, well, that sucks. Yeah, that just sucks. We went from like this promise of like a world's fair and entertainers and a months long event and a real celebration, inspiring patriotism and ideally celebrating success of the first 2 years of the second Trump administration. And now it's going to be just another Trump rally. Really? Like we haven't seen enough of those. Like that's what we're all looking for. That's what we're going to do to celebrate a quarter millennia of America's existence, is we're going to listen to Donald Trump brag about how much he's helped Israel. Okay, great. It really is pathetic, and it really is shocking how it's all Israel. Like, I get, you know, I get comments every day. It's like, oh, you're obsessed with Israel. What am I supposed to say? What am I supposed to do? They just kicked Sean Strickland off the UFC card. He's not even allowed to go. He wasn't going to compete. He just had a ticket. And they're not allowing him to go because he's not sufficiently pro-Israel. We should be celebrating the success of Donald Trump because he should have done mass deportations. He should have not gotten us to war against Iran. We should be getting what we want. Instead, we get absolutely nothing. They get absolutely everything. And we don't even get a birthday. We don't even get a birthday celebration. Israel has stolen our birthday, folks. They're basically the Grinch. It's literally constant. It's literally everywhere. I mean, let's go to the video. Let's watch this video where they compile a couple of the UFC fighters, including Sean Strickland. Clip 24 here. UFC kicks Sean Strickland out of the White House event. Let's watch.
I am at a loss of words, but not because of what Donald Trump has been doing lately. The current UFC champion of the world, the current middleweight champion, Sean Strickland, got a phone call from someone up in the echelons of the UFC saying he cannot go to the next event that Trump is putting on in Washington at the White House, the current UFC champion, Sean Strickland. Why? Because of his criticisms of a small little group of people that we're not supposed to be talking about, named Israel. Here's Sean sarcastically telling the story of what happened.
Well, you guys, I'm not surprised, but I got the call. I got the call. The UFC higher-ups called me, you know, the big names. They said, Sean, I gotta apologize, but you're not Israeli enough to go to UFC 250 Israel edition. The White House didn't clear you. And I'm not really surprised, you know? I'm not really surprised. So, you know, I think moving forward, I would like to just apologize to Israel. I'd like to say I'm sorry, you know? I'd like to apologize to Trump. And I just want to prove that I'm Israeli enough for you guys. Like, for instance, you know, whenever the list like disappear and Trump goes out there and says to everybody that that he can't really go into it because people that by association will get prosecuted and like their names will be tarnished. I want to apologize because, you know, I don't want them to be prosecuted. Or, you know, when Trump goes and bombs the fuck out of our Americans, $5,000 to $15,000 to go fight Israel's war. I want to apologize. Sorry, I've been a critic of that. You know, my allegiance was apparently in the wrong place, and I just want to apologize. Or when Trump goes out there and says, "Hey, Trump, your approval ratings are the lowest it's ever been across all demographics," and Trump says, "Well, you know what? I have a 99% approval rate in Israel. I want to apologize, and I want to repent, and I want to repent." You know. Apparently, I'm not American enough to go to Freedom 250, but I still got my ticket, so maybe we'll just go, I'll bring the belt, and we'll just stand outside the gate, and we'll just let them know what we really think about Trump and Israel, you know?
It's a good thing he has friends like Jake Shields and Bryce Mitchell who are also awake and speaking out with the influence that they have.
Did you see that Sean Strickland got banned from the White House for talking about Israel?
I'm not surprised at all. Freedom of speech is what really makes this country great. And when you can't criticize a foreign nation, come on, man. We ought to be able to criticize our own nation, let alone a foreign nation. In fact, that's the only nation you're not allowed to criticize. Something's going to change because evil empires don't last forever. There's always a rebellion.
What are your thoughts on the USC White House just in general? Like,
I do want to be on the card.
You do want to be on the card.
I do. And this is what I got to say. First off, I ain't jealous of any of those fighters. I am so happy for those fighters. If they need me to fill in, if I'm healthy, hey, I'll do it. For the UFC, I think it's great. It's beyond great. It's literally the perfect scenario. But what I think personally is that our government is desecrating its role in society by entertaining sports. Our government is to protect and serve the people and really should be as minimal as possible. When you're doing all of this stuff, hosting sporting events, it's really outside of what the goal of the government was intended to be, because our tax dollars and resources are funding this operation. And like I said, I'm not criticizing the UFC. I love Dana. I love Hunter. I love Sean, Mick. I love all of them. But the government should never be hosting sporting events, because there's more room for corruption, and we already have a corrupted government. The government is supposed to protect us.
Good job, Trump. Make Israel great again, Trump. You two right here should be ashamed of yourselves, and we will never forget what you did.
This is Sean Strickland going to the White House. Going to the White House, it was promised to me 3,000 years ago. I mean, you have to laugh. But they're getting kind of brazen, aren't they? I mean, typically, you'd expect them not to sort of flex the power that they have right now. Like, Sean Strickland hadn't killed anybody. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's probably committed less crimes than a lot of the other people that are going to be at the stadium that day. But, you know, I guess they feel that they can come out and show their power. How's that going to work out, I wonder? We'll be right back. I'm trying to figure out exactly where these videos are from, if these are the new ones. I've never seen some of these. So Epoch Times just published never-before-seen 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre photos. The Epoch Times obtained thousands of photos depicting the 1989 pro-democracy student protest movement in China's Tiananmen Square. For decades, film rolls containing more than 2,000 photos documenting the 1989 Tiananmen Square democracy movement had been shut inside a metal box never known to the world. These photos, taken by a Chinese state media photographer and having survived the ensuing political purging campaigns after the massacre, eventually made their way to the United States, where they were entrusted to the Epoch Times. Now, the Epoch Times is making the photos public for the first time. Thousands of people are estimated to have died on June 4th at the hands of the Chinese communist regime 37 years ago. Wow. Soldier issues warning to pro-democracy protesters. People erect barricades to stop Chinese troops from advancing. So there's this whole collection of new photos unveiled on the anniversary of the massacre itself. Communist authorities framing a peaceful student-led movement as a riot to disrupt social order hunted down participants nationwide while instituting systematic ideological re-education to erase from history all but their versions of events. Kind of like January 6th. People gather near Zhongnanhai, the Chinese leadership compound, following the death of reform-minded leader Hu Yaobang in Beijing in 1989. People mourn the death of that reform leader. People, again, holding signs and staging this. So this is very fascinating. Epoch Times, of course, is a dissident Chinese news organization. The photos, now scanned and digitized, provide a glimpse of those fleeting weeks in spring 1989 where hope hung thick in the air and more freedoms seemed so close at hand until the gunfire proved otherwise. Bullet holes left after Chinese authorities opened fire to suppress the pro-democracy movement in Beijing 1989. Among those photos are students on hunger strike wearing white cloth bands around their foreheads. They're shown linking arms and staging million-strong street protests with academics, media professionals, and military officers joining in solidarity. When the troops came in, these students and civilian supporters resisted with barricades and their own bodies. There are the Chinese military officers with the protesters greeting them. For some time, they succeeded as military trucks ferried tens of thousands of soldiers to Beijing. Following the martial law order on May 20th, the students blocked them, sharing food and water while explaining their cause. The troops turned back. Some of the photos show military officers waving to protesters. In one, several smile as they accept Yutao, golden brown fried dough sticks that are a Beijing breakfast staple. In another, a uniformed officer makes the victory sign amid a sea of protesters, many of whom are doing the same. So that's interesting. They're like, you know, sharing food and probably thinking that they're winning over the military, not knowing that the orders were coming for their extermination. Their upbeat spirit didn't last long. Late into the night on June 3rd, heavily armed troops marched in again. This time, they didn't hesitate to fire on civilians indiscriminately. The photographer documented bullet holes in a window and injured men on stretchers with blood soaking through their coverings. There were smashed heads, ruptured stomachs, spilling intestines around them, were mangled arms and legs, some still bleeding, the witness told, wrote on a public poster dated June 4th. Those were the bodies of six student protesters, the witness said, adding that everyone around except the soldiers were crying. The topic remains taboo in China. The Chinese authorities have harassed a number of people they deem to have been involved in providing the photos, including both Chinese nationals and citizens of the United States and Canada. Act quickly to eliminate the impact. Stop posting them, read one message from a Chinese police officer, which the Epoch Times obtained. Failing that, the officer warned, the targeted person would be on Interpol's red notice, arrested, and sent back to China. If that happened, the officer said, the entire family would suffer. Gee, what do you mean you don't like communism? Gee, what do you mean you're suspicious of socialism and communism? Don't you know how wonderful it claims to be? Totally mind-blowing the people in this country are communists. Totally insane that there are American people that think communism is in any way a positive at all. It's like the biggest failure of America that we haven't continued to drive home the evils of communism. And I think that's really what happened. I think, like, you know, 1989, the Soviet Union falls and we just sort of stopped, you know, fighting back against communism. We just sort of went, okay, we won. We don't have to worry about that anymore. But of course, it was already insinuating its way into our halls of power and never stopped. Another person threatened by a police officer told the officer that they're Canadian citizens. In response, the police officer said, you are Canadian citizens, you all are, but your relatives are Chinese citizens. The police replied, according to screenshots the Epoch Times viewed. When the individual suggested they would cut ties with their relatives in China, with whom they've lost touch for more than a decade, the officer was unmoved. It's too late, the officer wrote. Wow. So publishing pictures from an event nearly 40 years ago is enough for the Chinese to basically eradicate your family. Yeah, sounds about right. Sounds about right. Again, what other ideology does this to people? What other ideology gives people the ability to act this way and then still believe they are the morally correct ones? It's so evil. The Chinese police think they can enforce rules beyond China's borders. The person, a U.S. citizen, told the Epoch Times, they are arrogant enough to think that whatever the Communist Party says is the law anywhere, the source says. The targeted individuals have reported the intimidation tactics to the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. The Canadian Security Intelligence Service is also aware of the matter. Across China, communist officials have stepped up measures to censor any mention of the massacre ahead of the anniversary, as they've done every year. Several activists told the Epoch Times that the security officers had followed dissidents to ensure they didn't do anything out of line. Some reported restrictions on their movement. Others described police ordering them not to circumvent the internet firewall or post comments online. Chinese military general Zhu Qingjian in May 1989 paid the price for defying the Communist Party when he refused verbal orders to deploy troops against the demonstrators. For his defiance, he was stripped of command of the elite 38th Group of Army and jailed for 5 years. In a closed-door trial, he recalled telling the political commissar he'd rather lose the job than risk becoming a person condemned by history. Footage that emerged in late 2025 shows. Ennis Cantor Freedom, a former NBA player who's championed China's human rights issues, says he was not surprised to hear about the Chinese regime's suppression over the release of the Tiananmen photos. The Chinese Communist Party will erase everything from history that is going to be used against them, he told Epoch Times. He recalled seeing his name pulled from the Boston Celtics roster on Chinese media portal Sohu after he highlighted China's persecuted groups on social media. Chinese internet giant Tencent, which had a 5-year NBA broadcasting deal, pulled live streams of all Celtics games, a sign of how big of a dictatorship Beijing is, Freedom said. It's very shameful, and it's one more reason there needs to be more voices from the West to expose their hypocrisy. Just once again, it's just another, you know, great reminder to value and cherish what we have in this country. Because, I mean, the Chinese might be particularly ruthless, particularly capable in this regard, but, you know, this mindset is really not unique the world over. Our mindset is the unique one. Our mindset, our willingness to condemn our own government when they do wrong, condemn our own people when they do wrong, that is not an attitude shared by just about anybody. And it really is one of those things that Americans have trouble comprehending. Like, they may recognize it intellectually, but really understanding what that means, like what that's like, what's going on in the minds of these people, it is really, truly foreign to us in every possible way. Yeah, maybe it's just white people, but Americans in particular. And this is a pretty common phenomenon that we're running into more and more these days. The Carmelo Anthony trial, sort of a great example, that it is truly shocking to see the number of people who are in support of a murderer. They have no reason to believe that he's anything but a murderer. They don't believe he's anything but a murderer. They're just in favor of the murderer because he's like them. Like the potential juror saying, I can't send another brother to jail. Really, because he walked up and stabbed a kid in the neck and killed him, murdered him in front of his brother. You don't care. That doesn't bother you. No sympathy, no empathy, no concern whatsoever for the victims. And that, I think, is the thing that we don't understand. That's the thing I don't understand. I can understand how you might do something like that, how you might participate in a cover-up if you think it's really necessary, but I would expect there to be a sense of guilt eating you from the inside as soon as you do it, and from that point on. There's no guilt, though. There's not like, I'm doing this even though it's, you know, maybe not right. I have a loyalty, and, you know, there's no like agony over this. There's no like, no, it's feels good. It feels good, and it feels right to these people. And I can't explain it. I can't understand it. I don't want to be honest with you, but I do want to know my enemy. But I do want to understand what makes people that way so that we can prevent it. Because I do think it's a good thing, the way that we traditionally in America hold ourselves to a higher account, demand more of ourselves. And, you know, I guess you can go either way. I guess it's your preference. But to me, I'd rather live in a world where, you know, if somebody really does something egregious, like there's, you know, there's a difference, right? There's a difference between, you know, what some people have done, like the Antifa kid who basically turned his dad in for going to January 6th, sent his dad to jail for 10 years, even though he didn't do anything, even though he just wandered in. Like, that is maybe the most despicable act you can ever do. Like, loyalty to family is certainly extremely high in my book, but What do you do if your family member is a cold-blooded murderer? You know, how far does your loyalty extend? Again, I can understand, like, maybe your brother, your good friend gets in some trouble, and maybe you got to help him get away with something. You know, I think loyalty can go pretty far. But, like, if I found out a family member of mine just stabbed an 18-year-old at a track meet and then ran away and lied about it, it's like, I'm not with you. I don't care how close we are. You're bad. You're bad, and you're wrong, and you're evil until you repent. I want nothing to do with you. Or if our country does something evil, I'm going to point it out. And I don't, but I, the reason I'm kind of like struggling about this and even like talking about this like this is because it is also clearly a major point of weakness that white people are this way, that Americans are this way. Clearly, there is an advantage of having total loyalty to a group, and total group solidarity is obviously extremely effective. I just don't think it's moral. So I guess that's the struggle. It's like, well, it turns out, you know, being ruthless or overly loyal to your, you know, ethnic cohorts over and above all morality, turns out it's a pretty effective way to get what you want in this world. It just, a world of those types of people would be a miserable hell world of chaos. So I guess we'll keep trying to be moral while we can. There's also some video. I really can't tell if this is new footage or not. We can go to it on my screen. I don't think I've ever seen this, but then again, maybe I don't know if this is part of the new footage or not. I feel like I've seen at least portions of this before. Maybe more of it has been revealed than previously. But this, you know, these images really should strike fear into your heart. Should really let you know the danger of communism. And this view in particular, the low quality, the fact that it's just sort of this faceless mass, and then it zooms out and these people look almost just like a herd of antelope running away from the lions, and then it goes back up and you just see these faceless black shapes moving towards them. Some of the stories I've heard, and you know, there's so much misinformation, and of course the censorship around Tiananmen Square, it really is hard to know what actually happened. I've heard the most gruesome stories you could possibly imagine about Tiananmen Square. The official report from the ambassador, the British ambassador to China, he sent back a report about what he saw during Tiananmen Square. It was also secret for a long time. And, you know, maybe it's propaganda. Maybe it's not really what happened. But he reports that tens of thousands of people were killed, and that to clean up the bodies, they just ran them over with tanks until they were dismembered enough to wash down the drain with water. So your value under communism, right? Yeah. It's just crazy. It's just crazy that we live in a world that just over and over and over again, with absolute certainty, it's demonstrated that certain ideas are just awful and people just won't accept it. And we actually I have to sit here and I have to actually argue against a sizable portion of our country that actually wants us to become communist. As if every single time it's been implemented, it hasn't been the biggest disaster the world has ever seen. The most egregious and horrifying abuses the world has ever seen has occurred in gulags and to this day in Chinese prisons. I mean, I'm sure you've seen some of the videos, the Chinese torture devices. I mean, a video slips out every once in a while, and you'll see a Chinese guy literally strapped to a chair as other Chinese guys are, like, torturing him, like, every single time. Every single time communism is tried, it results in the most horrific abuses ever. and yet we still have to sit here and argue about it? What the hell is wrong with everybody? It's enough to make you feel insane. I want to go to some other videos. Let's go to clip 10 here. This I heard on the way in, and it's, you know, I don't know how to feel about it because, you know, I'm raising my kids basically as screen-free as possible. We do like movie dinner night once a week, right? Or we'll, you know, on occasion show them something. But for the most part, screen-free. It makes being a parent significantly harder, I have to admit. Screens are practically magical when you have a kid. Truly, it is shocking. There have been times where our son used to wake up when he was like 2 years ago. He would wake up in the middle of the night and kind of be having these like night terror things. You just couldn't calm him down. And we would spend an hour doing everything we possibly could to try to calm him down. Any strategy that we could have. Do you want candy? Do you want food? Can we get you something? Can you do is it? You need to stop right now. Nothing worked. Nothing worked. And there's one particular time. We spent literally an hour and our son was just wailing full volume the entire time. Finally, my wife goes, well, why don't we try to show him a video? I pull out my phone, and it was literally like a straight hour of, and he just locked into the phone and just stared at it. And it was like, this is like magic. This is crazy. This feels like cheating. This is too easy. So I can understand how you can fall into the trap of just like, you give your kid a screen, and they are gone. They're gone. They just sit there. They don't bother you. They don't complain. They aren't whining. They aren't crying. They just sit there. The problem is their brain is rotting through their nose. The problem is every minute they sit in front of that screen, their IQ drops a point. Their eyes unfocus. Their dopamine receptors, you know, get fried, and you are literally destroying them. So on one hand, I'm like, depressed at the fact that our kids are going to be growing up where everybody their age is going to be a zombified idiot. On the other hand, no competition. On the other hand, if you are raising your kid in traditional ways, not relying on screens, you're basically building superheroes compared to their fellows. So this is kind of depressing on one hand because of how horrible everybody is. But on the other hand, if you have a kid, just know that they're growing up with a bunch of mindless retards that they're going to have to compete against, which would be a good thing if you were selfish. I don't think it's a good thing. Let's go to clip 10 here.
So after about 20 years of teaching, the teachers and I have noticed that the kids keep getting more difficult every year. And by difficult, I don't mean like I don't like them and they don't like me. I just mean like they really lack the foundational skills that school requires, whether that be the foundational social skills, fine motor skills, gross motor skills. Gross motor skills meaning like they fall out of their chairs. They drop the Chromebooks every day. Thankfully there's carpet in here. You know, the boys want to touch each other nonstop. If I had a dollar for every time I said boys stop touching each other, and this is middle school, I would have thousands this year. Thousands. Not the girls, especially not this year. No girls holding hands or anything like in previous years. But the boys, they're dying for affection. Do you know at home tickling your kid or like patting their shoulder or like playing with their hair is all considered affection? Boys need more affection. Okay. The middle schoolers, so like the fifth graders going into sixth grade next year, 1,000 times harder than the sixth graders this year. The sixth graders this year, 1,000 times harder than the sixth graders last year. The dopamine centers in their brain are fried. They're addicted to devices. The Chromebooks are the devil. The cell phones are the devil. Roblox is the devil. It's all ruining the kids. And it's not about personal preference. Like, they cannot critically think. I don't have my students on Chromebooks, and I don't have them copying or doing notes. I make them use critical thinking every day, and they hate me. Today, they're making a poem called The Where I'm From Poem, and they have to actually use their critical thinking. They have to think about their home. They have to think about adjectives that describe their home, and every day, they're burnt out on that. That's what this generation lacks. Nobody's making them think critically, and nobody's really holding them to standards that are very simple. Learn to care for yourself. Learn to understand like personal space and body language, you know? So I'm very concerned about this incoming group, and I will keep trying to do the tricks that I do, which come from raising an emotionally intelligent child and how to talk so little kids will listen. And I've even read books on ADHD and oppositional defiance, because that's where we're at now with most of the students. Now, the fraction of students who don't operate like that will be just fine. They were already going to be just fine because their parents communicate with them and their parents hold them to a certain standard. So, and literally just valuing education and creating a home environment that allows your child to focus on their education is the best thing you can do as a parent. And sometimes I know that's asking too much of parents, to create an environment that values education. I'm talking the bare minimum. I'm talking you make your kid go to school 4 days a week. I'm talking you make them clean out their backpack twice a month. I'm talking you check their grades 3 times a semester. I'm talking, you know their teachers' names. I'm talking bare minimum. I'm talking there is a book in your kid's room that they read. Bare minimum. That's what we need now. Off the Chromebooks as well. Off the phones.
So any society that allows this to happen to their kids is an illegitimate society. And this didn't just happen to our kids. This was deliberately done to our kids. Schools would not get funding if they did not accept the Google Chromebooks that are programming them to be lifelong consumers addicted to these products. This was your government doing this to you. So, again, you know, I don't know what I can say to people, but it's like, this is your kid. This is their life. You're making them weak and stupid. What is wrong with you? Do I have to convince you to do this? It's like, I don't know, man. It's a little bit hopeless. I have to admit, it's a little bit hopeless. I'll try to refill on hope and have more to deliver to you tomorrow. Go to thealexjonesstore.com to support us. We'll see you then.